Are you feeling naughty? That's right. It's Life and Equinox podcast time. Wow. So if you had your money on Life and Equinox podcast number 5 being the worst opening in the history of podcasts, I think you're actually the pool winner. That was pretty bad, wasn't it? It's a shame, really. I spent weeks planning that. Had it all scripted out on my blank sheet of paper in front of me that I pretend is to hold as if I have some bland information. Oh well. Hi, my name is Univarn. This is Life and Equinox podcast number 5. My blog is Life and Equinox, which can be found at univarn.blogspot.com. That's Univarn, univarn.blogspot.com. Today's topics are Paris When It Sizzles, Princess and the Frog, Screen Actor Guild predictions, and my top 5 tearjerkers of all time. Pretty exciting stuff, isn't it? You know it is. Alright, let's dive right in. Paris When It Sizzles stars William Holden as a screenplay writer who's had sort of 18 weeks to work on screenplay, and he's been living in Paris, and he invites Audrey Hepburn, who plays a typewriter, up to his apartment to write the screenplay, or to transmit it from his written portions to typing. But when she arrives there, she figures out really quickly that he spent the last 18 weekends drinking, traveling around Europe, and with women, and hasn't done a darn thing, and now they have 3 days to turn in a completed script. And so William Holden tries to buy time by, you know, charming her and all that, because she's ready to leave. She's like, I don't want to deal with this crap. And it's a romantic comedy, and it's a whole lot of fun. So many times when I leave romantic comedies, I leave them just kind of like, oh, glad that's over, because the jokes are just so bland. There's questionable chemistry, if chemistry at all. And let me just start by saying this. William Holden and Audrey Hepburn, the chemistry is marvelous. You know what I mean? They have it down pat. William Holden plays it well, too. You know, he's got the hairy chest sticking out and all that sort of stuff. And he really sweeps her off his feet. Off her feet. It'd be kind of awkward if he swept her off his feet. I think that's called a trip. Oh, well, moving on. But, yeah, they had such a great chemistry together. And I really loved watching them together. And I think that made it just all the more enjoyable, because not only do we have them sort of interacting and writing the story together, you can see a lot of the background behind writing a screenplay, the thought that goes involved, the lack of thought that goes involved. And they play off well together. I think that just makes for a really enjoyable experience for the viewer, because you want to walk away from romantic comedies with two feelings. One, you've just seen love, at least on, or some variation of such. And two, you've just had a great time. And that's what Paris When It Sizzles gives you. You walk out of there going, aw, they're good together. And you walk out of there going, that was hilarious. And at the crux of the comedy, though, is sort of a cameo/bit part played by Tony Curtis. And to say that he's funny in this role is an understatement. The guy is hilarious. He plays himself, but not really himself. He plays himself playing somebody else, and it trust me, it's just hilarious. I almost died laughing watching this. And when he comes on the screen, it's just, it is so good. And the movie really plays well off of its own sort of quirkiness. It's not trying to be, you know, this big, powerful, dramatic, romantic comedy, and I'll always love you, darling. That sort of stuff. It really just tries to be quirky and upbeat and fun and off the wall and make fun of Hollywood in its own way. Because it does like a lot of little subtle jabs, especially at Audrey Hepburn, because they make a lot of references to Audrey Hepburn movies, which I just found hilarious. You know, he's talking about how My Fair Lady is, you know, just another version of this movie and that movie, and it really just plays well, and I highly recommend it. It was a lot of fun. And yeah, that's all I got to say about it. I'm going to move on to another fun movie that I got to watch this week. Princess and the Frog, Disney's new animated film. Hand animated. If you follow my blog at all, you know I love my hand animated movies. Sorry, Pixar. You do a lot for me, but you don't quite have the finger touch. But this is directed by Ron Clements and John Musker, who also worked on the story, and I think the screenplay as well. And we all know why it's sort of infamous, historically at least. But watching Princess the Frog actually kind of hurt me a little bit emotionally, because in the back of my mind, I knew that this movie cost $100 million to make. and it has yet to make $100 million at the box office. And you might not say that's too depressing, because, I mean, you know, when it gets released international, it's probably going to shoot that out of the water, if it gets released international. Why that's taking them so long? Not a clue. But Alvin and the Chipmunks 2 has made almost, like, 3 times as much money as Princess and the Frog. That should just come with, like, a warning label for our society. Alvin and the Chipmunks 2. Because our society doesn't care. Period. And that depresses me, but it's a lot of fun. It's not that great of a movie. It does play a little bit on Disney mythos, and I liked seeing the strong characters. Some people poured down my review of it. You know, you've only really had Mulan, and maybe you could argue Belle. I think she's more of an emotional character than a physically strong character. And Anika Nani Rose plays the main character extremely well, and it really builds that sort of dynamic relationship with Bruno Campos, who plays the romantic prince, in a funny accent. Don't ask me why. I didn't write the screenplay. But for me, the highlight of the movie, and I don't know, because maybe I'm such a dark and depressing person, the highlight for most Disney movies was the Shadow Man, who was the villain of the movie, and is played by Keith David, who I've always adored. I think Keith David is one of the best actors people don't know anything about, because he's just awesome. And he's got the perfect voice for villains, because, you know, some people just don't have the voice for villains. Like, I don't have a voice for a villain. I'd be, like, the worst villain ever. Stop it! I'm gonna beat you up! You know what I mean? So, you know, I'm not a villain, but Keith David has that deep James Earl Jones kind of voice, and it just works real well, especially here, because he plays, like, a smooth-talking, sort of tarot card reader slash voodoo guy slash made a pact with the demons. You know, a rather creepy guy. And he plays it so well, and what makes it work so well is how they use the lighting with him, I think. Because he has, like, his sidekick, which is the shadow, and, you know, there's some shots where he turns and looks at a shadow, and they wink at each other and nod, and those are just great, great creative stuff. I love that. And that's what I feed off of with animated movies, is how can you bend what we can't do so easily with a camera to make it work within an animated film, and it does a good job at that. It's not perfect. It's a little predictable. At times, I felt like it was rushing the characters too much. It's like, you know, one of those movies where just one obscure event happens, and all of a sudden, they're in love. And I didn't buy into the romance, at least the way it develops in the movie. I could see it happening, but I don't think it was developed well enough in the movie. And that depresses me, because I think Disney historically does a good job developing its romances in movies. Well, not historically. If you think about it, Sleeping Beauty, I mean, not much of a romance there. But there's some movies that it does very well, like Beauty and the Beast, it does an amazing job with the romance there. Lion King, I think it does a good job there. And so it can do that, and I think more modern Disney films do a lot better job at it. And here, I think they just kind of dropped the ball on developing the romance and just sort of went for the, well, if we show them two doing something together, they'll be in love, right? Isn't that how it works? Two people will walk down the street together and punch a redneck with a shotgun, and they're in love. Wow. What do you mean that's not it? Come on. Psh. Rednecks, watch out. You're going to have a lot of angry people coming after you soon. No, we have to punch him. Why? We'll be in love. Ah, oh, man. That's horrible. All right. But it was a good entertaining film. It wasn't the best movie, you know, OMG all time type of stuff, but very enjoyable. And it sort of goes to my next movie, which was just another enjoyable film. It's nothing special, but it's just enjoyable. And that was Guy Ritchie's 2009 Sherlock Holmes reboot with Robert Downey Jr. and Jude Law and Rachel McAdams and Mark Strong, and it was just a lot of fun. It took me a little bit of time to get into Robert Downey Jr.'s very deep accent, so I spent a lot of the first few minutes going, huh? But once I got into it, and once I sort of attuned to what he was doing, it started to make sense, and I thought it was a lot of funny. A lot of little one-liners are snuck in there, but I think his accent kind of muffles them, that were pretty funny when I was watching it, and I started giggling, and everyone around me was just dead silent, and I was like, my sister would look at me and be like, what? What did you hear? And I was like, oh, he said that. And then she'd start laughing, and the people would just be staring at us because they couldn't hear it because I think of the accent he went with. But it was a lot of fun. I enjoy Mark Strong as a villain, which is bad to say because he seems like he's a really cool guy. But he just has that villain face. I don't know if we can really explain it. I guess because he's played villains so much that that's what we associate with him. But he does it very, very well. And the score by Hans Zimmer, I mean, I don't think that's gotten enough praise. And I think the worst part of musical score is it tends to just go to the Best Picture winner or something like that. They just kind of, you know, oh, here you go. And there's a lot of great scores. And Hans Zimmer's score this year really sort of samples from Once Upon a Time in the West, especially the harmonica theme from that movie. If you don't know, harmonica is the character played by Charles Bronson. And Once Upon a Time in the West is an upcoming film in the 1001 Movie Club, so look out for my review of that, because I do love that movie, and it will be there. But he samples a little bit from Once Upon a Time in the West, and he really combines this sort of like Victorian, medieval mesh of really just sort of simple tones, and it just makes this amazing musical score. It was one of my best of the year. You can go to my Life in Equinox Award 2009 and look up the music stuff, and you'll see that. You can click on that and listen to some samples from it. But I do really recommend listening to it. It's an amazing score. And the movie just really complements it. And I think that's important for a musical score. I think with James Horner and his Avatar score, the score just felt like it was overwhelming the scenes. Lord of the Rings was a movie that sort of invited that sort of loud, overwhelming dun-da-da-da-da-da score. And Avatar, a lot of the scenes, it just felt like he was like, quick, make it loud as possible. I need noise during these scenes. And it just felt forced to me. But here, Hans Zimmer did perfect. The movie's a lot of fun. It's a little quirky. You kind of know what's going to happen because they make a point to show you things like two or three times. I'm picking up this can. Let me show you a flashback of the can being used. And now I'm going to point and look at the can again for about a minute and a half. This might be important later on. Hint, hint, remember the can. You know, they do a lot of that, which kind of was like, all right, I get it. Shut up. But it works very well. It's a lot of fun. Guy Ritchie, this may be a good comeback for him. Maybe not. I don't know. He needs to just keep it simple. I think he sort of went through some years there where he was just trying so hard to do everything at once. Like, this is big, it has to be this, and it has to be that. And I've got to not look like the usual Guy Ritchie. It's like, you don't have to not look like Guy Ritchie, but just do the directing basics. I think that's all any of us really ask of you. And I think that really kind of makes it work. But, you know, I don't know if Sherlock Holmes really has the strength as a movie to continue on long-term with this. I mean, it's really going to depend on how their sequel rolls out, because they can really bomb it or really make it work very quickly, because I think they walked a real thin line here, especially with the Rachel McAdams character, which they kind of develop as a, this one's going to be important in this sequel character, and then they sort of, you know, toss out all these things, and they spend too much time building the sequel and not enough time on the story. But if you are looking for a good Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon, solid entertainment, highly recommend Sherlock Holmes. Next comes with the Screen Actors Guild predictions. I have to admit, I don't really care much about the Screen Actors Guild. It's not that I don't admire them, but it seems a lot like self-patting on the back. We're so awesome, we're gonna vote for ourselves. You're the man. You know, I don't know, I'm not a big fan of that, but it was requested, and I shall oblige. Kind of. It's going to come with uni stipulations. I'm not going to do all the TV stuff. I love TV, but who wins TV awards doesn't matter to me, because my favorite TV shows never win TV awards. That's right. The lack of love for Bones, Fringe, I'm calling you people out on it. Get in gear. And I'm not even really going to do female actress in a supporting role and male actress in a supporting role. Do I have to? I mean, if Monique and Christoph Waltz don't win, that'll be more important news for next week's podcast than it would be if they did win. I don't think anyone's surprised. I think they both deserve the win, but I'm not going to go into it. So I'm going to dive right into Best Actress in a Leading Role. Yay! And it's kind of like the usual suspects. Sandra Bullock, The Blind Side. Helen Mirren, The Last Station. Carey Mulligan, An Education. Gabri Sidibe, Precious. Meryl Streep, Julie and Julia. The only one of this I haven't seen is Helen Mirren in The Last Station. But I love Helen Mirren, but I think she's sort of the fifth person that everyone's kind of debated who they're going to throw in. Melanie Laurent, Helen Mirren. It's So I think she just kind of gets the one vote or the other sneak in here. I'm having trouble here because my heart says Carey Mulligan and Gabrielle Sidibe deserve to win this. But this is the Screen Actors Guild, and they're almost as bad at times as the Golden Globes at patting the backs of buddies. You know, hey, we did that movie once where I was holding the Coke and you were over, you know, starring in the movie. I want to vote for you. So that I can tell you that I voted for you and maybe get a role as guy number one holding the Coke instead of guy number two. All right. That's horrible, but they do that a lot. And so I would not be shocked at all if Sandra Bullock won. They also have the world's greatest love fest for Meryl Streep. I think she's won like 4,000 of these. Somewhere in that range. I think she gets 10 a year. I'm not sure what the quota is, but I would love to see Carey Mulligan walk away with this. Because like I said for the Golden Globes, she has such an amazing cute factor, and she handles all the scenes, the little scenes, so well in Education. Which I feel so bad, because I'm end up championing her and Gabrielle Sidibe so much, and they didn't even make my top 10 movies of the year list. Their movies. But they did make my best performances of the year. So, there is that. And yes, I can distinguish best performance from best film. It's a talent. And I'm going to go ahead and predict Meryl Streep wins this. Because for whatever reason, they always give her the award. I don't know why, they just do. It's one of those weird things that nobody can explain. And if Sandra Bullock wins, I wouldn't be surprised. But in my heart, I'm cheering for Carey Mulligan and Gabrielle Sidibe. And now we have Best Actor, which is Jeff Bridges for Crazy Heart, George Clooney Up in the Air, Colin Firth The Single Man, Morgan Freeman Invictus, Jeremy Renner The Hurt Locker. Since it's the Screen Actors Guild Award, I'm going to say Jeff Bridges, Crazy Heart. He's paid his dues. Everyone loves him. Public, media, fellow actors. He has a triple threat right now in the voting categories. And so I think he just gets this win by default. I don't even know if any of the other guys on this list will generate enough buzz to really even get nominated. To a level in which, you know, they can viably compete with him. But you never know with that stuff. And then we have Outstanding Performance by a Cast in a Motion Picture. And Education, The Hurt Locker, and Glorious Bastards, 9, and Precious. Huh. I think Inglourious Basterds kind of has to win this. I mean, 9, if this was done 2 months ago before it was released, 9 probably would have won. The Hurt Locker has a great cast, but nobody, I think anyone in the Screen Actors Guild really attaches to. And Education is a good threat here because they have so many good performances in it, and lots of people like Peter Sarsgaard, Alfred Molina, a lot of good up-and-comers, Dominique Cooper, that are all sort of scattered in there that people really enjoy. Precious might win, but it only he has a couple performances. I would be shocked if Precious won, but I think if you go by sheer amazement of the cast throughout the list, it kind of has to be Inglourious Basterds, because they were all so amazing, and there were so many of them that were good, you kind of have the best cast performance. But I would not be surprised if any of the ones won here, because it's just the Screen Actors Guild, and I don't care, and I don't follow them enough to really figure out what they predict, you know? It always just sort of feels like I just feel disconnected from it, to be honest. But we're going to move on. This has been kind of one of those downer weeks for me. Just, you know, school starts back up and all that sort of stuff. And so I started to think about my top 5 tearjerkers of all time. Kind of stealing the Mad Hatter list thing, which I don't intend to do. It just sort of happened because I started writing it down the other day. And I was like, you know, I should just do this in a podcast. And so if I was to label my top 5 tearjerkers, and I'll do a little commentary, but not much, I think number 5 would have to be Braveheart. I don't remember a lot of emotional combat coming throughout the film, but when the movie ended, I was just like, you know what I mean? I don't cry a lot during movies. I'm not a macho guy. I just don't connect so much that I cry a lot. But that movie really sort of hit that, you know, that little sniffle button on me. I'm like, you know, that weird little thing. I don't know. It's depressing. Man points down 5. But it was just a well-done movie, and that ending sort of brings all the emotion into one scene. It's really impactful. Number 4, The Green Mile. If you didn't cry during that movie, Where is your soul, man? Where? It's such an emotional movie. I just love the way it's done. I've watched that movie several times since. I just love the way it's done, and I think the ending just provides such an emotional impact that it really resonates with you hard. And it makes it that on repeat viewings, I've really sort of watched for that emotional connection. Like, where did I start developing the emotional connection that led me to feel that way for the character? And it's just such a great, well-done design that it really works well. I mean, it's an emotional film. There's no denying that. Now, number three on my list kind of comes from my love of animals. And it's, I think, the classic tearjerker in a sense is that it's Old Yeller. And when I first watched this film, I was, I think, 10 years old. I was at a friend's house, and I wasn't really paying attention. And so I didn't feel anything. And a few years later, I went back and watched it again, because I was like, oh, well, it's not that bad. It was on TV. And at the end of the movie, I was just in tears. It was just impactful. It really was impactful. And I admire the way it approached its own story. It wanted to develop the love with the character, and it wanted to sort of remind you that you can love your animal despite the bad that happens to it. I mean, you don't have to, you know, feel nothing just because it did something bad. You admire it for everything that it was, you know? And I really enjoy the way that developed. And I want to revisit it one day because it's been so long since I've watched it. But, you know, I'm afraid of that emotional stuff again. And number two, that's all right. I'm on number two. All right. Moving on. This is pretty quick. Yeah, it's going to get long in a hurry. Number two is a movie that holds a very big distinction for me. And it's on my top films list. It has always been on my top films list, and it will always be on there. It is the film Glory. Edward Zwick's 1980s tale of racial tensions during the Civil War and the first African-American unit. And people harp on this a lot. Matthew Broderick playing a colonel. Shut up. That's right, I said it. This movie literally was the first movie I can truly remember being moved to tears watching, which is a very rare feeling for me. Like I've said, I don't cry a lot during movies. And when the ending for this movie came, I had the tears coming down, and I went out and I told my mom, you have to get me this movie. It was so amazing, and I felt so much for it, and I admired it, and its score, and all of it just made for such an emotional film. And there's that final shot, and you have the musical score just blaring, and you see this grave of soldiers, and I won't say who, because that'd be a spoiler alert, and I just got so, you know, choked up and emotional, and it was just like, ah, oh, that's beautiful. And it was beautiful because it was sort of completing the what the film is trying to tell you. And at the same time, it's an emotional ending because, you know, it's war. Not everyone's going to survive. And it makes it work for itself. And that's just the way it had to be, I think. It couldn't have worked on any other level than that ending. And I think because of that ending, I admire it all the more. And I've seen that movie countless times since then. So you can imagine, it's not just one of those things that I like. You know, everyone else is like, oh, I like that movie. Oh, yeah, me too. No. That is not how it goes. And now for number one. Big drum roll and everything, right? My number one tearjerker of all time. And I'm going to preface this by saying, recently, Mad Hatter talked about movies you'd never watch twice. You could not revisit that experience without being some sort of insane. And this movie is that one movie for me, that one movie I will never rewatch. Even if you tied me down, I would never rewatch it because of the pain that goes into that ending. And that is Isao Takahata's Grave of the Fireflies. If you don't know about this film, don't be surprised. It's a 1988 anime film. Now, I know you're probably thinking, oh, anime, yada, yada, yada. I will tell this to everyone out there who has any opinion of anime. If you have not seen this movie, you know nothing of anime. I will defend the quality of this movie to my own grave. That is how powerful of a movie it is. Because I will tell you, I will give you, set the scene for you. The credits roll in this movie. And I'm sitting there in my chair, looking at my screen. And I have tears coming down my face. like a water fountain. And I do not stop crying, I think, for 4 or 5 hours later. That was how painful and emotional of an ending that film is. And I tell you what, even when I think back now on it, I still get a little choked up. That movie is a movie I would never watch again for all the money in the world. I recommend it to everyone because it is such an amazing film. But it is so painful of an ending. And it tells you the ending 4 minutes into the movie. It says, this ain't gonna end well. Because that's just the way it opens. And it tells you that right off. And it still hit me so hard in the gut. It felt like, you know, the first love lost and all that sort of came back. And it was just, wow. I have never experienced that before. I never want to experience that again. And so if I was a label, my number one tearjerker film of all time, it is Grave of the Fireflies. Watch it. I know I just gave it, like, you know, probably the worst endorsement of all time. That watch this movie, it's going to make you feel bad forever. But if you want to see what quality animated films can look like, true quality, watch this movie. It is, by all definitions, I think, possibly the definitive anime film of all time. And I know Spirited Away is higher on my top 100 list. That's just a personal preference. But if you were to point to the movie I think that most fans of anime would agree is the number one anime film, Grave of the Fireflies is going to appear on every list. It's just that good. And I'm going to end it on that excitingly chipper note, right? Best tearjerker of all time. Go watch this movie. It's so depressing. But I know we all have a lot to get back to do today. Whatever day you happen to watch this, or listen to this, rather. Either way. So, I have been Univarn. You have been a listener. This has been Life in Equinox podcast number 5. Hope to see you next time. Bye.